Welcome to Radio Gorgeous. Gorgeous Reads presents Rosanna Amaka and the Book of Echoes. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Rosanna.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Your book has sort of burst on the scene this year as a bright and beautiful thing. Both its wonderful, vibrant colors and its wonderful, vibrant contents.
I'm very grateful to my publishers. They've done a wonderful job on the cover. Yeah.
It's very striking. The book is also very striking. Can you introduce us to the story?
Okay. The Book of Echoes is narrated by an enslaved African woman who lived over 200 years ago. And she's captured in Africa, and at the time she has a son on her back, and she throws her son into a shrine in order to save him from the same fate, and she gets dragged away. Eventually she finds her way to the London docks here. I think at the time it was called the West Indies docks, and she has a second child, and that child is also taken away. So it's her spirit roaming the earth trying to find those children, and in the process of trying to find those children she comes across Michael, who lives here in Brixton, and Ngozi, who lives in Nigeria.
Her spirit, as you say, sort of lovingly haunts the book. But she is seeking her children ceaselessly. And we don't know her name.
Yes, because there's many of my ancestors that we don't know their names. Yeah.
And these were... That, I found, is a theme throughout the book. That the trauma that is visited directly upon your characters is named. But other traumas, historical traumas, almost horrifically to say everyday traumas, are not named. And I thought that was a very powerful thing, because if you put a name to that, then I can buttonhole it. Yeah. If you put the name Stephen Lawrence out there, I have a stereotype in my head. I put brackets around it in time and place. Mm-hmm. If you don't name it, it's endemic.
Well, I wanted people to read the characters and understand that these characters are human beings, and to feel what those characters are going through, and to say, there for the grace of God, go I, basically.
Yes. And you counter that so amazingly with hope, because the hopeful things that happened during that time, Nelson Mandela being released, you do name. And it puts our focus not on the things we can't do something about, but on the things that can and will and have been done.
These things are the things that keep us going. If we, there's lots of terrible things that happen in the world, both past, present, and I hope that, you know, that it will reduce as we become more knowledgeable of each other, and in the future, I hope that we will treat each other better in the future. And I wanted to remind people of the good things that have happened in order to give them hope.
Yeah. And there was, and I did find this sort of the downward pressure of trauma through history, but also a real acknowledgement, and that has sincere and horrific repercussions throughout generations.
Yes.
But so does the resilience. So does the survival.
Yes.
The sheer fact of it.
Yeah. Yeah, that, you know, the sheer fact that I exist to me is a miracle. When I think of my grandparents and I think of their parents and their parents, the fact that, you know, that they went through, I'm talking about particularly on my father's side, who comes from the Caribbean, when I think that, you know, he that line came all the way to me, I'm just in awe of that resilience.
Mm, and that survival.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This book is both, you know, we've just talked about sweeping history.
Yes.
You know, a woman from a village in Africa kidnapped and enslaved from the 1700s. Mm-hmm. And you as a writer is sort of like that character. You're both this sweeping through time, place, and history, but it's also very focused on Brixton. And it's sort of a love song as well as a lament,
yeah,
for a now dissipated community. Tell me a bit about that.
It is a love song. And I suppose that, as I said, when I sit down sometimes and I think of the things that that I see people go through, I have seen some, you know, some very, very strong people. I'm not as strong as them, but I just marvel at some of the things that people are able to get through and continually get through. And so it was a love song to them. Yeah. And a thank you. Yes.
For having survived.
Yes.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And persevered. Tell me about, because hope in the book is such a powerful force, and you've talked about your sort of marveling at and gratitude for the power of resilience, mm-hmm, and hope in your family's life. How does it play a role in your life?
I am fortunate enough that I am surrounded by strong women. So it's only when I took, when I was growing up, for granted some of the things that they handed to me. So I just assumed some of the, for instance, I assumed until I got to school that all women worked. That all women had to juggle. It's only when I got to school that I started talking to other women that I realised, I mean other children, that I realised actually some women do stay at home. And I marvel at them as well, because it's not easy coping with a whole, you know, with children and the pressures of that. But yeah, I'm lucky enough to have been cushioned by the women in my life, yes.
That's interesting that you say that, because I, you know, grew up in New York, and the first time I ever heard "you can't do that because you're a girl" was when I went to Vassar College.
Yeah.
I went to university before I heard it. I'd never heard that before.
Yeah.
And it's such a shock when you have been surrounded, mm-hmm, you know, positively or negatively, but you've been cushioned, as you say, mm-hmm, by your family. Like, what?
Yeah.
What? That's like a thing? Like we're doing that now.
I'm an engineer by background, so one of the questions that I keep getting asked is, oh, you know, what about going into engineering? And you know, in my household, it was, what did you want to be? And I had good examples. Okay, they were male examples, but it didn't, you know, that they were engineers, but I didn't think, oh, okay, because they're a male that I couldn't do it. It's only when I went out in the world that I thought, oh, actually, there's not that many of us.
Where are the women? Yeah. Yes. Where's everyone else? Yeah. Why am I the only one?
I do feel blessed that you know, by, as I said, the women in my life, and I am very much in admiration to them. Yeah.
Mm. I would say the book is dedicated to your mother and your grandmother.
Yes.
Tell me about the writing of this book, because you've been a writer since a very young age.
Yes.
And this is your first debut novel.
Yes.
You said you've taken 20 years to write it. Tell me a bit about that process.
Okay. As I said, I was working in Scotland over 20 years ago as an engineer. And at the time, I was kind of homesick. So, and I also didn't have a TV. So I thought, okay, let me use this time wisely and put pen to paper. And I had a few stories milling around in my head, and I sat down and started to write it, and this is the story that came out. So over 20 years ago, I wrote it within 6 months. I wrote mainly the skeleton, but it's taken 20 years of rewrites and rejections, etc., to get here.
How does it feel now that it's sort of out there? Like, when I read it, mm-hmm. it becomes mine in that way. Like, I, you know, how I read it, what I interpret.
Yes.
You know, it's sort of, you're sort of like a director, sort of letting the actors now have the stage.
Yes.
How does that feel?
It feels wonderful. Mm-hmm. Anybody that connects with the book, I'm in awe that I was the vessel that it came out of. But if you connect, it speaks to you, and some people have told me that it has spoken to them. I'm grateful. But yeah.
Where have you found the voices in the book? Because we know sort of from the beginning that the two main characters will collide at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But we go on the same journey that they go before they meet each other.
Yes.
And you have very strong voices from Nigeria, mm-hmm. from Brixton, from Scotland, mm-hmm. from wherever. Tell me about that process.
Well, I'm surrounded by all these voices, you know, in my everyday life. I've traveled quite a lot. These are the voices that I've come across in my everyday life, but also during the writing of the process, their particular voices came out to me. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, very strong.
Yeah.
Very strong voices. But I also noticed that there's not along with what we were saying, like sort of the downward pressure of trauma through these generations of people, but also history,
mm-hmm.
both here and in Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
But there's never a political comment, which I find really refreshing.
Okay.
That it's not, I mean, it's, you allow us to have that.
Okay.
But you don't judge the characters, we don't judge the characters on that basis.
Because I think there is political, I believe that there's political
yes.
content in there, but this book is more about life.
Yes.
It's about the journey of life.
Yes. Yes, no, it definitely has, impact
yes.
on them.
Yes.
But we see the results, not the direct comment.
Because I to a certain degree, I want people to if they're reading it, to actually look about. So you can read the book on a macro level, which is the everyday, but you also need to read the book and think on a macro level what is happening globally. And that's up to the individual reader to find that out for themselves and filter it down to their characters.
Yes, and that's where the narrator becomes very helpful, because we experience very visceral
mm-hmm.
From the inside.
Mm-hmm.
And the historical perspective is very helpful.
Yes.
By bringing that together and bringing that to bear on our assumptions of every day.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell me who Olaudah Equiano was.
Okay, he was an abolitionist during the late 17th century. And he was instrumental in providing a narrative, which I read and helped me with the enslaved woman's narrative. And he was key in the UK in getting slavery abolished. He's one of the people that helped that process.
Mm. Yeah.
And if you do get a chance, if you haven't read his book, please do.
I wanted to ask you, as a writer, what decisions you made about leaving things out. Because there's things that you don't explore. There's one thing in particular,
mm-hmm.
which I just think it's a joyful surprise that you either kept for yourself or allows to detonate in my head,
yes,
as the reader. Tell me about those choices and how you make them.
Can I ask you, what was it that detonated in your head?
I'd love to see the moment when Sheridan sees Ngozi with Michael.
You mean Sharon? Oh.
Is Sheridan Bailey? Doesn't he teach, isn't he the Bailey's son that teaches Ngozi how to use computers at first?
Oh, okay. The reason why they don't actually, they don't meet is because I find that you know people through people.
Yeah.
And that's what happens in life. You know people through people, and then eventually maybe you might actually come at a party, go to a party and realize, actually, I've known this other person for years. And so it's the coincidences of life, yeah.
I would say, but those, to me, that was really powerful, because always when you're falling in love, it's those coincidences, mm-hmm, that sort of reinforce your idea that you were meant to be, that you should be, that fate has brought you together. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was just really nice that I got to have that sort of myself. I could picture that. I could picture where they were.
Yes.
In Sheridan's parents' place. And you know what I mean? I could picture that Sunday lunch. I mm-hmm. could picture the surprise and the joy, mm-hmm, and all of that. And so was that a conscious decision?
I think, as I said, it was a conscious decision not to explore it, because, as I said, that's the coincidences of life. And you have to give... It's also about giving space for the reader to actually continue that world.
Exactly.
In that
as
story.
I did.
Yes.
I followed my instructions well. Exactly. To the letter. I did it. I wrote it. I was there. I pictured it. You gave me all the tools. Exactly. Well, and that's really, I do want to say that you are a very generous writer in that way. That and you have trust in your reader. Are you a reader in that same way? Like, what do you look for when you're reading?
It depends on what I'm reading. I'm more going with the flow of what the actual author is trying to do and understand, but on different levels. So I understand it as a reader who's enjoying a story. I try and understand it as a writer. What can I learn from this writer? So there's different levels that I actually read a book on. Mm. Yeah.
And the process of coming to publication, mm-hmm, because it was a long process and you obviously felt like you were ready.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand you were possibly going to self-publish.
Yes, I was. I was.
So what brought you to that brink and then tipped over?
Because, as I said, it was 20 years of rewrites, sending out rejections, etc. And eventually, 2017, I decided, okay, this is going to be it. I'm going to do the last lot, send it out, and see what happens. And I sent it out and got a whole load of rejections back again. And I thought, okay, I'm going to self-publish it. It's a story that I want to get out there. If only one person reads it, then only one person reads it. But my mother insisted that she wanted me to print to get the book published, and she wanted to also share it with her friends as well. So
I want bright rights.
So I got the book together, and I was just about to I was getting the book together, and I came across an old rejection letter from 20 years ago, and at the bottom of it said keep blah blah blah, this reasons why we're rejecting, and keep in touch. So I thought, okay, shall I or shall I not? And I thought, I've got nothing to lose. So I phoned up the number and left a message on the answer machine. And then I got a call back I assume it was a secretary, saying, what am I talking about? And so I said, okay, I've got this letter. I can send it to you. And while I'm sending it to you. She said, oh, she said, send me a copy of the letter. So I said, okay, while I'm sending it to you, I'll send you three chapters as well. So I sent it off and I didn't hear back from them for about three months. I assumed, okay, this is it.
Same old story.
Yeah, same old story. So, and then I sat down to actually go onto Amazon to, because I had the ISBN number and I was just about to get it upload. And as I sat down, an email came in saying, I've just read these three chapters. Have you got a synopsis? And I sent it off to them. They got back to me and they said to me, okay, she said to me, I'm going to hand you over to my commissioning editor. They found me my agent, the Good Literary Agency, Nikki Chan, and then from there they found me my publisher's Doubleday. So it was just
random.
Yeah.
But again, hope.
Yeah, hope.
20 years later, yeah. Don't remember me. Sure,
don't give up.
Wow. Incredible.
Yeah.
Absolutely incredible. Okay, so of course this begs the question, do we really have to wait another 20 years?
No. Definitely not.
Exactly. So yeah. Are you writing now?
Yes, I am.
Fantastic. That is brilliant news. Rosanna Amaka, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous, and thank you for the Book of Echoes.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on.
And for more hopeful and fantastic women, go to www.radiogorgeous.com.